Improving Society in less than 30 minutes. The short podcast of Körber Stiftung. Why has the EU recently released a strategy on the Indo-Pacific? How come a region so broad and so distant to Europe receives so much attention by European countries? And how do developments in the region affect European politics and the economy? One of Körber Stiftung's dialogue formats, the 177th Bergedorf Roundtable, dealt with these questions and invited experts to share their ideas, debate, and most importantly, come up with solutions. One of these bright minds, Lynn Kwok, explains some of the complex dynamics at work in the Indo-Pacific. She also participated in the 10th Berlin Forum and is a Munich Young Leader. Lynn is a multi-talented researcher, teacher, speaker, and analyst working for Asia-Pacific Security with the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and I am very excited to hear what she has to say about the Indo-Pacific. Improving Society with Lynn Kwok. Moin! Or hello.
Hello, Diana. It's very good to be with you today.
We love to have you here, and you today tell me a lot about things that I barely know about. So we start off with the Indo-Pacific region and the Asia-Pacific region, which is something that we hear a lot in the news. For example, we heard a lot about Myanmar. What exactly are these two terms referring to?
Well, I think your listeners would know the Asia-Pacific region, but recently we've been hearing a lot more about the Indo-Pacific. And that's a geopolitical concept that seeks to capture the integral link between the Indian and Pacific Oceans as one strategic operating theater. The concept highlights the importance of the maritime domain for regional security. In the Indo-Pacific region, security is largely, though not exclusively, maritime security. Japan and Australia have long thought about the region in these terms, namely, you know, the importance of the maritime domain. But Indo-Pacific terminology really only gained momentum after it was adopted during the Trump administration. And the fundamental reason for this change of nomenclature in the United States can probably be summed up in one word: China. And also the US desire to maintain the balance of power in the region. So as Professor Rory Medcalf explains in an important recent book, The Indo-Pacific Empire, it was principally about recognizing and responding to China's widening strategic horizons. Different countries in the region take different views on the Indo-Pacific's geographic reach. In the US conception, it stretches from the western shores of the United States to the west coast of India. The Japanese conception stretches a little beyond that to Africa. What is clear, however, is that in the Indo-Pacific terminology and in this new concept, India becomes a critical player in the Indo-Pacific mix. And this is important for balance of power reasons. Now, Southeast Asia, which is the region from which I come, lies at the geographic heart of the Indo-Pacific. And for this reason, I think its views on the concept are important to understand. And if we're thinking about European policy and strategy towards the region, I think it's important for Europe to understand a little bit about how ASEAN and Southeast Asian countries as a whole look at this concept. Many considered the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific issued in July 2019 as evidence that ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is throwing its weight behind the United States and its free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. But I think the reality is far more nuanced. The ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific is a very carefully calibrated document. And although it mentions the Indo-Pacific, it also recognizes the importance of infrastructure development, and this was an important nod to China. The document also eschews mention of the quadrilateral security dialogue, which is a security dialogue between the United States, Australia, India, and Japan. It's sometimes called the Quad. This China doesn't like at all. China does not like the Quad, which it regards as a containment strategy. So the ASEAN outlook really seeks to focus instead on the need to promote economic integration and connectivity. Now, even the title of the document suggests distancing from the Indo-Pacific concept. Diplomats from the region have taken pains to point out that it is the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific and not ASEAN's Indo-Pacific outlook. I mean, it's a very fine statement there. Yeah, a fine distinction there, but nonetheless an important one to make. And I think this arm's length approach towards Indo-Pacific terminology points to a broader reluctance in Southeast Asia to take sides between the United States and China. And this needs to be borne in mind as Europe seeks to engage the region. Mm-hmm. It could also make Europe and Southeast Asia natural partners.
So you already talk a bit about China, and obviously that's something we are all well aware of. But can you tell us a bit more about some of the flashpoints of the Indo-Pacific region? Because I know that you've been dealing with a lot of different parts of it.
Sure. The four main flashpoints in the region, and your listeners might well be aware of them. There are the tensions on the Korean Peninsula, Taiwan, the East China Sea, and the South China Sea. You mentioned China, and we've already talked a little bit about U.S.-China rivalry. In all of these cases, U.S.-China rivalry is merely exacerbating pre-existing issues, and it's doing so either directly by making these issues yet another arena in U.S.-China competition, or indirectly by making the issue harder to manage. In each of these four cases, Korean Peninsula, Taiwan, East China Sea, and South China Sea, we could, as Evan Medeiros of Georgetown University has outlined in a Council on Foreign Relations report, have pathways to conflicts which could involve either intentional action, strategic miscalculation, or an accident which then escalates. So it's all quite worrying. So four flashpoints with them becoming even more intense and heightened because of U.S.-China rivalry. I think recently we would have heard much talk about potential Chinese military action against Taiwan. So I'd like to briefly touch on that. There's been great concern about this issue, and rightly so. But my view is that short of an outright declaration of independence on Taiwan's part, which I consider unlikely, given that we generally have rather level-headed Taiwanese leadership, I think short of that outright declaration of independence, Beijing will avoid military campaign in at least the short to medium term. And in this respect, I share the view of former colleagues at Brookings Institution who take the position that first, China cannot be sure of winning a war involving the United States quickly or at all, and this would deter Beijing from action that would undermine domestic confidence in the Chinese Communist Party. And second, that China's goals remain to avoid Taiwanese independence rather than to, at the present moment, compel unification. I also take the view that military action against Taiwan would be contrary to the approach that we've seen China take towards other issues, such as in the South China Sea, where China has sought to rely on a salami slicing technique, that is, small provocations, none of which constitute casus belli or call to war, to make incremental gains. So I think China is far more likely to rely on these salami slicing techniques in the case of Taiwan as well than outright military action against Taiwan, at least in the short to medium term. Mm-hmm. I think China has other tools it can, however imperfectly, rely on, namely coercion and intimidation, as well as economic incentives wherever this is possible in the case of Taiwan. If you'd like as well, I could speak a little bit about the South China Sea, which I work closely on.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I think the South China Sea is a very important issue, because there we don't only see the risk of incidents at sea increasing, at sea or air increasing, but there's also a slow burn of a rules-based order that is under threat by China's actions, fortifying disputed land features and features under the clear sovereign rights and control of other states, as well as China's attempts to consolidate its claims and control over the waters of the South China Sea. So China has, you know, sought to increase its control both on land features as well as the waters around features in the South China Sea. And this undermines the rules-based international order. Despite the pandemic, we've seen China's activities continue unabated. And in some respects, these activities have arguably intensified. I don't think I'll go through all of these activities. They're just way too many. But I think it's useful to highlight three main categories of them, at least in the waters of the South China Sea, which each pose different problems for the rule of law. Germany always talks about the importance of the rule of law and maintaining the rule of law. So let's understand how China's actions in the South China Sea undermine the rule of law. So first, we have Chinese encroachments into the exclusive economic zones of Southeast Asian littoral states, so Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. China has sought to either prevent these Southeast Asian states from having recourse to their economic rights within the exclusive economic zone, or China has itself actively sought to explore and exploit the exclusive economic zones of these littoral states. Such encroachments directly contravene the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and the 2016 International Tribunal ruling on the South China Sea in the Philippines case against China, whose main significance was to clarify resource rights. The upshot of the tribunal's findings is that the Philippines, and by implication, the other Southeast Asian littoral states, enjoy exclusive economic rights in their EEZs, unencumbered by China's controversial nine dash line. And I think some of your listeners would have seen the dash line that China draws over the entirety of the South China Sea. China is also not able to claim EEZs or exclusive economic zones from features or groups of features in the Spratlys or from Scarborough Shoal, which is a feature just to the west of the Philippines main island. A second way in which China's actions in the South China Sea undermine the rule of law is that China has attempted to limit passage and navigation and other freedoms of the seas in the South China Sea. And such actions have included insistence on prior authorization for warships to exercise innocent passage in the territorial sea of waters around Fijis, China prohibiting military activities in the exclusive economic zone. Military activities are actually permissible in the exclusive economic zone. And China has also sought to draw straight baselines over certain features, even though geographic conditions for drawing them set out in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea are not met. And the implication of this, or the reason why this is important, is that straight baselines convert the waters within these straight baselines into internal waters through which other states are not entitled to sail without permission. So this gravely limits the ability to exercise passage and freedoms of the seas and should not be permitted. So such attempts to limit passage and freedoms of the seas are clearly inconsistent with the convention, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea.
So that clearly points out how many different tensions there are in how less we probably are aware of all these. From a personal and also professional point of view as a psychologist, I always have the impression that people tend to just look at what affects them specifically. And the great thing is that you've been to so many different countries and cultures. You studied at the University of Cambridge, at the University of Singapore. You've been to Greece and London. So you kind of, I don't want to say a holistic perspective, but you can look at it from different countries and different point of views. And obviously, me being from Germany, so Europe as a broader view, I would like to know, how do these tensions in the Indo-Pacific region affect Europe?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Diana. Thank you for that. I think the obvious answer is that, you know, tensions in the Indo-Pacific could affect Europe's economic interests by hurting access to the region, including through limits on freedom of navigation. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, and perhaps a little bit less obviously because it's less stark, developments in the Indo-Pacific, a region whose importance is only set to grow, gravely undermine the rules-based international order, which in turn negatively impacts Europe's both its economic as well as its security interests in the region as well as closer to home. Where a rules-based international order is undermined in one part of the world, especially in such an important part of the world, it's also undermined elsewhere. So it's not geographically confined. You talked about earlier about how, you know, the natural reaction is to only care about developments closer to home because it feels closer, it feels more dangerous or threatening. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the erosion of the rules-based order, even when it's close to us, we don't notice it, you know, until slowly it disappears and we see our freedom of action being constricted. And this happens, you know, whether you're close to the problem or you're further away as well. The whole point about the rules-based international order and international law is that it's international in nature. So you can't say that, you know, the international law has been undermined in one part of the world. Don't worry, we're in Europe, far away, we're going to be okay. But I think that where we have threats to the rules-based international order and international law in the Indo-Pacific, I think it's going to be felt, at least in the medium to longer term, in Germany as well and in Europe as well.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. And that's about the impact that it has for us. Also, why is it important for Europe and even Germany to engage the Indo-Pacific?
I think the many opportunities and challenges of the Indo-Pacific make it imperative for Europe and Germany to engage the region. Engagement helps to take the edge of US-China rivalry, which is very sharp at the moment, and contributes towards defending the rules-based international order. The differing interests and relative strengths of each European country will influence, of course, their individual approaches to the region. So in the case of France, France has overseas territories and about 1.65 million citizens in the Indo-Pacific. 93% of its exclusive economic zone is actually located in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. So France has adopted a more forward-leaning security role in the Indo-Pacific and also plans to integrate itself more deeply into the regional security architecture. Germany recently sent the frigate Bayern to the Indo-Pacific. This was in August 2021. By doing so, indicated a degree of willingness to increase its security engagement with the region. But I think it's likely to play a more limited role than France or the UK. The Bayern set sail only 2 years after it was first reported that Germany was contemplating sending a warship to the region. And as I understand it, the next deployment is not expected for at least another 2 or 3 years. Nonetheless, you know, Germany engages in other ways, and ASEAN and Southeast Asia as a whole welcomes many of the initiatives that Germany has outlined in its Indo-Pacific guidelines, which it issued in late last year. These include strengthening multilateralism, tackling climate change, protecting the environment, promoting the rule of law, strengthening free trade, digital transformation of regions and markets, and expanding cooperation in the fields of education and science. Germany needs to be careful, though, about its stated a desire to focus on strengthening the human rights situation in the Indo-Pacific. This needs to be approached quite carefully, given deep sensitivities in the region.
If we look at the actors in the Indo-Pacific, what are the interests and expectations of them towards Europe?
Let me talk about Southeast Asia, which is the area I know best. I think Southeast Asia has broadly welcomed increased European interest in engaging in the Indo-Pacific, even though their visions for the region might not be perfectly aligned, including on human rights and perceptions of the threat that China poses. Of course, given the proximity of Southeast Asia to China, they feel the threat far more deeply. And in a sense, they consider that as tying their hands. But Southeast Asia considers the presence of European powers to be potentially very helpful in maintaining the balance of power and taking the edge of US-China rivalry, and also, importantly, expanding the region's strategic options in the face of US-China competition and concerns over long-term US commitment and wherewithal in the region. There was a poll that was conducted by the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies of Elites in the region, published, I think it was in January 2021 this year. And this poll clearly supports Southeast Asia's welcome of European engagement. It found that the EU, and by this the report actually means EU countries, so the EU countries and Japan are clear front runners for broadening ASEAN's strategic options in its attempts to hedge in the face of US-China rivalry at 40.8% and 39.3% respectively. The poll also found that the EU countries remain the second most trusted power in the region after Japan, and quite far ahead of the United States, India, and China. Southeast Asia did not in the past, I think, generally regard Europe as a serious strategic player in the region. But I think this is also slowly changing. Actions that have boosted Europe's credibility recently include British, French, and German assertions of maritime rights and freedoms in the South China Sea, statements by European countries to the United Nations in September last year rejecting China's maritime claims in the South China Sea and affirming the 2016 UN Tribunal ruling in the Philippines case against China. And also the rolling out of various European Indo-Pacific policy documents, I think, have all helped to bolster Europe's credibility in the region. I think it's also important to note that in the region, they look at how European powers are not only upping their individual games, but they also look at how they're working closely with allies and partners. For instance, the British carrier strike group included a Dutch frigate alongside US destroyers, as well as 10 US strike aircraft. So it was a multilateral effort. And I think being able to work multilaterally, having close ties with allies and partners, is considered to be a force multiplier and well received in the region. What's also well received and has helped to boost credibility in the region has been Europe's increased economic engagement with Southeast Asia, which has been much appreciated. It's important to remember, however, that attitudes in Southeast Asia have been influenced as much by enhanced European engagement as by a growing sense of urgency provoked by deteriorating security conditions in the region. And while Southeast Asian policy elites often say that they do not want to choose between the US and China amid intensifying great power competition, this formulation of not wanting to choose actually obscures parallel fears over unlawful and coercive actions, not least in the South China Sea, where China has built on and militarized many features and encroached upon coastal states' exclusive economic zones. Mm-hmm. So the framing of not wanting to choose also sidesteps Southeast Asia's concerns over long-term US goals in the region, whether this is about dominance over China and whether these put the great powers on a collision course. So I think, you know, the European engagement is seen as a welcome mix to that fray.
And if we break it down to Germany, is there anything specific you'd say the region expects of the new German government?
Maybe expects might be putting it too strongly, but if we talk about a wish list, it's nearing Christmas after all. I think the region would like to see Germany play a role that clearly and strongly supports a rules-based order, but one that doesn't exacerbate or unnecessarily exacerbate US-China tensions. So it needs to take a firm stance to support the rules-based order, even where perhaps China gets angry, but it should avoid exacerbating US-China tensions. I think this involves several things. Defending a rules-based order in a region where development needs are high and growing given the pandemic is likely only to gain wider traction if the Indo-Pacific vision has a strong economic component. And I think Germany perfectly understands this, and Germany as well as the EU are particularly important economic players and can think about better leveraging their economic strength for geopolitical ends. But I think to just focus on the economic angle in the case of Germany would be to miss out an important element. And while European powers might each place different emphasis on security versus economic engagement, neither is sustainable without the other. A security-heavy approach would deny Europe important tools to shape the region, while serious Indo-Pacific security challenges, and we talked about them earlier, render an economic-only approach unsustainable if the rule of law is to be maintained. And I think Germany needs to take a hard look at the tools it has available to it and not neglect the security angle. Working with allies and partners, it can boost the impact of its engagement, however modest, and even if it's at a relatively lower level than its other engagements. So I think it's important for Germany not to just talk about the economics, however important that is, but also to offer up some security support in the region as well. The new German government, with the Greens and Liberals as part of this government, is expected to be tougher on China, on human rights and democracy. You know, no one objects to this, and human rights and democracy are very important issues. But I think these issues need to be approached sensitively in the region. emphasizing ideology or overemphasizing ideology could result in, first, unnecessarily deepening distrust and divisions with China. Second, it could also alienate potential partners in Southeast Asia, a region, unfortunately, of illiberal democracies and authoritarian states. And third, it could also leave a vacuum for China's influence, which could in turn lead to greater erosions of democracy and democratic backsliding, which is not what Germany would want. So I think Europe in general, and Germany in particular, has to be cautious about the unintended consequences of an approach emphasizing or overemphasizing democracy and human rights.
Speaking of democracy, obviously that has been a big topic for us on the Berlin Foreign Policy Forum, where we both have met. You have been there twice already, and also you have been part of the Bergedorf Roundtable, where we also facilitate talking with and to each other rather than about each other. And you were named a Munich Young Leader in 2013. So obviously, I have to ask the question, how has it been being part of the Munich Young Leader program, and how did it have an impact on your personal and maybe your professional development?
I cannot overstate how important the Munich Young Leaders program has been to my personal and professional development. It remains, in my view, the gold standard of young leader programs, and I could not be more grateful to have been a part of it. The Munich Young Leaders, as some of your listeners might know, are about 20 or 25 young leaders who are selected to participate in the Munich Security Conference. Mm-hmm. And that in 2013 was my very first opportunity to interact with world leaders in my field and to be able to engage in high policy discussions. So that was, I guess, awe-inspiring to be able to be exposed to that caliber of leaders and discussions. And, you know, it was truly an eye-opener for me. Since then, the Körber Stiftung have been very good and very generous in bringing together alumni from the Young Leaders Program at regular gatherings in different cities around the world, where we've been able to not only understand these cities and their countries a little bit better, but these gatherings have also helped to foster a genuine sense of community amongst past and present Munich Young Leaders. And this is a group of incredibly talented, inspiring, and wonderful group of people. I mean, it's a wonderful community. Now, I recently had the opportunity to spend 3 weeks in Berlin at my institute's new Europe office. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful to be able to meet many Berlin-based young leaders there. I had to conduct meetings as part of my work, but for me, it didn't feel like work at all. I just happened to be meeting dear friends who were all part of important decision-making and analysis in Germany's foreign policy, and the insights that they were able to provide were invaluable. And I just felt so grateful to have been there and to have been able to spend more time with these young leaders. The other thing about the Munich Young Leaders Program is that in fostering these close ties and exchanges, the Munich Young Leaders program also helps to make a broader contribution to international dialogue and understanding. And, you know, for me, it's been a great privilege and honor to be a small part of that. So I'm, you know, I keep on saying this, but I'm exceedingly grateful.
Thank you very much. We couldn't be happier to have you on board. Maybe as a final question, I just wonder, what do you think, how does this affect all of us in our everyday life? So why do we need to engage in these debates and in these programs whenever we can?
Well, I think it's always important to push ourselves to learn more, to understand more, to challenge our assumptions. You know, we might come to the table thinking, I know all there is to know about a particular subject, and then be exposed to quite a different point of view. And through that, we are able to learn and grow as people and hopefully use that knowledge and that growth for the betterment of societies and the countries from which we come, and overall, the betterment of international society. And I think there's no better place and time for that now, given the great stresses that the international community and the world are facing right now. We face so many problems, not just in the Indo-Pacific, but globally as well. So if each of us play a small part, you know, through the programs that the Körber Stiftung and others organize and convene, I think we are all at least taking baby steps towards helping to improve the situation and hopefully aim for higher heights.
Absolutely. And there is so much more you could talk about, and I can only recommend everyone to dive deeper deeper by visiting your website and watch some of the videos or read some of your articles. I personally find it very exciting that you're not only experienced in front of the camera, but you also worked as a senior producer. Therefore, you find only high-quality material behind the link in the show notes. Remember that knowledge is power, and we all need to take those baby steps that you talked about to make the world a better place, or to improve society in less than 30 minutes. Thank you very much, Lynn Kwok.
Thank you so much for having me, Diana. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.